And I'm Gary Gress from Sandia. What I want to do is tell you today about the work I've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years, I mean, since I moved to Sandia 4 years ago, on granular flow. And most of us will talk about flow, and at the end I'll say a few things about packing. Before I get started, I'm using slides because I've got some movies and data to show from the simulations, but this is basically informal, so feel free to interrupt and stop me as we go. Two postdocs, Leo Silbert, who's been with me almost since the beginning for over 3 years now, finally kicking him out, and he's going to go to Chicago and work for Sid Nagel and Andrea Liu. And James Landry, who's a graduate student at Chicago, just joined us in the fall. Steve Plimpton is our expert parallel computer person, physicist who's been very good in parallelizing the code. And we've been working with Denise Ertaj and Thomas Halsey from Exxon, now ExxonMobil, and Dov Levine from the Technion. And Alex has been involved in a little bit of starting things if he ever gets his act together. But we know about that. Anyway, the two things I want to talk to you about is mostly chute flow, that is pack flowing of granular materials down an inclined plane, and then packing. And the reason granular materials are interesting is a number of reasons, one of which is I have this very expensive demonstration here, which is, if you take granular materials and pour it, you make a mound, okay? But that mound is very metastable. It depends on how I poured it, and if it's with liquid, of course, it would fall on the table. And if I shake it, okay, eventually it'll go to a lower energy state. Okay, so very much of the granular material properties are dependent on history, depending on how I made the packings, how I started the system off. In fact, so one of the reasons we actually looked at the chute flow problem was because we were actually looking for a problem which that did not occur. We wanted to get to a case where we could look at simple rheology and not be worried about history dependence, but just only able to reach a steady state. Other things, like the packing, or you pour things into a container or you pour them into a mound, then you have to worry about how you did it. And there's lots of controversies about packing, et cetera, which I will allude to at various points.
It's also unclear on how long would take to approach in steady state too.
Well, of course, this mound, for instance, originally started, it'll sit there forever, right? Because there's no time, there's no temperature, there's no, and one of the issues, even for the steady state problem of the flow, in fact, it's very, very long. Mm-hmm. And then some of the things, we made some quick estimates, if you take micron-sized balls and try to pour them down an inclined plane, you need a football field long trough before you reach steady state towards the end. Okay, so people who do chute experiments in 6 foot long troughs, which is kind of impressive, in fact never actually reach steady state before the stuff falls off the end. Okay, there's a lot of problems of interest, and I don't want to spend any time on this.
Sorry, I have an interruption there. So in the chute flow, supposing I'm one of these foolish people doing a 6 foot long experiment.
Yeah.
If I make measurements at some point in between,
yes,
the statistical properties of that measurement presumably will be stationary, right?
At that, yes. If you sit at 4 feet down the trough and watch,
yeah, you'll get a statistic. Time series of some up stuff.
Yes.
So in that sense, it is steady state. It's just that there's some others,
Right. That steady state depended on what happened up the hill and the details of how I input the particles in, and has some history dependence. All right. Absolute steady state is I go far enough down that I don't care how I started the thing, and I've completely forgot about everything. Okay. And that's the difference, in terms of the length scale. When I get to the results, I'll make that more clear.
That you do reach steady state way downstream, or is that just an empirical observation or a simulation?
It's an observation from our simulations. And it's when you see that there's enough motion, both parallel, particles moving perpendicular to the flow direction, mixing it up, and eventually getting to the point where we don't see any evidence of everything stationary.
Because one could imagine, depending on how you dump it at the top, something.
Well, in fact, we don't dump it in because in simulations we just run it. Let me go to the simulation and I'll show you what I mean by that. But
this a ratio of length scales of the size of the particle and then the football field that you mentioned, that seems like it should depend on the inclination angle.
It'll depend a little bit on the inclination angle and the type of the particles and how inelastic they are and everything else. That's just two football fields or a half a football field. But
Could he have a critical angle like they did? Is there friction so that?
Yes. Yeah. Let me get to the details. Okay. What we mostly were started off being interested in is and as many of you know this, people are trying to develop statistical-mechanical models of granular materials. Edwards and many others have tried to define things which are temperature, you know, which are some fluctuations around the mean temperature. I mean, you've got to put energy in somehow by tilting it or dropping it or somehow put energy in, and then if you look at fluctuations around that mean flow, you can define a temperature. The question is whether that is a temperature in a how well defined a temperature is in a thermodynamic sense. How can you do statistical mechanics? And there are people who think that you can, and there are people who think you can't. Okay. Now, the difference, of course, between these granular particles and small molecules is one is, of course, we're talking about particles which are big enough that they don't have to worry about thermal energy. Okay. And big enough they don't have to worry about other interactions. I can treat them as basically cohesiveless, dry particles where they only interact when they come in contact. Okay. If you get very, very small powder like jeweler's powder, then you have to worry about charges and they'll stick together, the moisture, etc. So we're going to be in the limit now where they're much, much bigger, boulders or grains of sand or something. So I don't have to worry about that. But, of course, there's friction. When two particles come in contact, they rotate against each other and you get a shear force and you have to account for that. And they deform. And then, so you get dissipation. So everything's inelastic. Okay. And so we want to basically do that and try to see if we can come up with some what are the stresses, etc., so we can understand how one might do a continuum calculation. You know, what would you put as the constituent equations into a continuum model? And there are some experiments, particularly on packing, there's some on flow. There's fewer because of this issue of steady state. Just a little bit of advertisement. We, meaning mostly Steve Plimpton and Leo Silbert, have taken our standard molecular dynamics highly parallel code called LAMPS and put in rotation, put in friction, time-dependent friction. So particles come in contact, they rotate, and you have to keep track of how much they're rotating before they will slip. And we've had that to a parallel code, which we can now run on basically any set of machines. We run them on a cluster of deck alphas. They also run on any bare wolf cluster. We've got polydispersity. We can vary the hardness, the coefficient of restitution. That's how inelastic the collisions are, the frictional forces, etc. Our limitation now is that they're spherical particles. Okay, so we're going to do spherical sand. Okay.
But the things that are elastic, you deform it a little bit, but then they still spherical. Right?
They're spherical, and the I think on the next slide I have the forces. What you have is, where's the great pointer around here? You have a big stick or something?
Right on the floor next to your feet, Gary.
Gary? No, that's our Gary.
Oh, my Gary. The other Gary.
I'm focused.
Okay. So kind of a minimum model, and this is a minimum model for granular materials, is that you have a normal force, which is just it's basically a half a spring. If they're not touching, there's no force. As soon as they come in contact, there's a spring. There's a prefactor, which depends on the overlap, and if you depends on if you do what's known as linear springs, or simply you just take a spring, so that's delta over d, or in three dimensions, Hertz Midland worked out many, many years ago, 100 years ago, that, of course, when you push things together, the surface area changes, and so you get an extra half power here. So this force...
Do you actually find that you need to do this?
No. No, it doesn't make any difference. Everything I'll show you, we've actually done, we flip back and forth and do both. You can either use, say, this will either be 3/2 power or 1 power, depending on which model you want to use. But it turns out it doesn't make any difference. There's a damping term in the normal direction, which accounts for the fact that the collisions are inelastic, and I vary that. The one advantage of a linear spring is that if this linear spring, then you can actually work out the coefficient of restitution, and that's a constant, independent of velocity. If it's a Hertzian contact, then what happens is coefficient of restitution depends on the velocity. And the lower the velocity, the less the collisions become elastic as you go to the low velocity limit. Okay, but it doesn't really matter because we actually input a gamma sub n here. Okay. Then there's a shear force, which basically accounts for the fact that as particles come in contact, they're rotating, and so you actually integrate over the amount of strain, and you put a spring another spring constant, same factor of F, and a spring constant. These two are kind of same order of magnitude, and you can also add a damping in the transverse direction. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. And then one has a Coulomb criteria, the standard Coulomb criteria, that the tangential force should never exceed the normal force by some coefficient mu. And mu is usually typically of order a half or something, like same as we used to in sliding bricks down an inclined plane. Okay, so this is kind of the minimalist model of simulating granular materials. People have done slightly more complicated models where one maybe takes the force, normal force, to be a little bit different on the in direction as opposed to the out direction, kind of a ratchet model. And if you do that, you effectively get, again, accounts for the inelastic collision, which we do as this term.
Do you get any sense that we throw away all the dissipation?
No. In fact, for the flow down the inclined plane, there's another the minimalist model is one that I use, you can use, which is actually to take the frictional force to be not related to the strain, but just the relative velocities, instantaneous, kind of an instantaneous friction. And if you do that, flow down inclined plane is always unstable. Okay, so you actually need to put in some kind of a frictional force with a relatively strong damping. Basically, you have to suck the energy out fast enough to make sure that, you know, gravity is putting a lot of energy in when you flow down inclined plane or drop it.
Okay. Unstable in respect to what?
I'll show you in a second.
Sorry, Gary. The symmetry terms and the velocity terms, I'm just going to make sure they're the friction.
These two? Right. Yeah, those are the inelastic collisions.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
There's the that's the amount to lose energy. The inelastic collision, in this case, if I had F equal to, say, 1, sorry, it's a normal spring, and then the coefficient of restitution is dependent on the exponential of this gamma. So the larger the gamma, the more inelastic the collision.
I guess I'm not understanding why this F is outside this bracket.
Oh, why it's outside the bracket as opposed to inside the bracket? Because it turns out if you do this, put the bracket over here, then you get, let's see, you don't get the right. Let's see. Somebody worked out let's see. I can't remember what you do wrong.
Little f is just the Hertzian orbit.
Right.
And that's the elastic definition of the spring.
Right.
Right.
So if you do the Hertzian case, in order to get the correct coefficient of the coefficient of restitution to depend properly on velocity, you actually have to put an F factor there as well.
That's the Newton's. How do you press something together?
Right. Well, that's for this part here. He was asking about why that would appear in the damping, why this delta, the 1/2, would appear times this term.
Well, in the normal one. But in the transverse one, that's just the normal Newton.
Right. Well, we're worried about the damping terms, not these two terms, but the damping. It turns out that if you don't put this factor delta in here, I can't remember the details, but you can show that you don't get the coefficient of restitution to depend on the velocity properly.
And so, ineffective looks like a notation of effective mass.
It is.
Is there inertia here?
No, but this is still the effective mass between two particles. So it accounts for the fact if I have one stationary, like on a boundary, and a particle moving, it gives you the right. You have to.
Of course, there is inertia.
There's inertia. You still have inertia.
No, presumably your simulation has inertia, right?
Yes. Right.
But also, normally frictional forces depend on relative velocity, not on relative momentum. So I don't understand the mass sitting there.
Yeah, that's the last question.
This is a damping term, remember? This is on the damping.
That's not an inertial.
No, this is the damping term, remember?
Well, right. But
forget about these two. Look, those are the force, normal and shear force. Okay. This is just a force that says if two particles don't interact until they come in contact.
Those terms are fine.
Okay, these terms are the damping terms.
Yes. See, gamma is in units of inverse time.
Yeah, right.
It won't be consistent. Yes.
Well, no, because then you have.
Depends on what units of gamma. Depends on what units of gamma I have.
No, but so you're pulling the mass out to make gamma have units of inverse.
Right.
That's the time constant.
You just pulled out a factor of m effective. It's not like you keep track of particle masses in that term, or do you?
I do.
So then I'm puzzled, because you know, if you have two things moving past each other,
yes,
then the frictional, the viscous or frictional forces depend on relative velocities, whereas somehow you make it seem as though they depend on momenta in some way. Now, if you're telling me it doesn't really matter, you just pulled out a factor of mf from the friction, then it's okay.
This is the reduced mass, the effective mass between two parts.
I'm worried about what sort of mass it is. It's just whether we have
mass at all.
Dimensionally, it's a matter of convention. What really matters is how it depends on the particle mass.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, all the particle mass is actually coming into it.
And you say it's the reduced mass of the two colliding particles.
It's the two mass of two colliding particles. It accounts for the fact that when I have one stationary and one not, two moving versus one stationary and one not, which would do with the walls, I have to account for the. For how much damping I'm going to put on the normal force.
So the mass of the particle on the wall is infinity, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Well, effectively, you do that in kinetic theory. Right? You separate the center of mass motion and relative motion, and the effective comes in the relative motion.
Right.
Yes, but if I have the same particle, the same surfaces, and the same grandeur flow traveling the same velocity, and I just sneak a bit of lead in the middle of them or something, you're saying the dissipation.
Dissipation is different.
But that's strange.
So why?
Right. Well, or the time part.
No, it's true.
I mean, just like, you know, viscous damping in a fluid depends on velocity gradients, not on momentum density gradients. So it's another way of putting it. So I'm just puzzled by that.
No, but that's, I mean, that goes back to you slide two plates against each other, and there's has to do with the micro roughness, doesn't it? What you're doing is you're bumping.
Right, but it only depends on the load. Right, depends on the load.
Yeah, so that's why the load comes in, because these things are, you're actually lifting, you're separating and collapsing them together again. And so that's why the friction is tangential. Friction depends on the load.
Well, that should be area of contact, not by mass. It's very strange.
It's not the mass.
And the other, Coulomb friction things are anyway separately put in terms of
heat. Right. I mean, this basically is put in, the way I think about it, this is put in to account for the fact that I have two types of collisions, which is between particles which are both moving, and one which is moving, one which is a wall. Okay. And so I have to account for the fact when I do that.
So to try and answer this around my wife, are you saying that embedded in here is not just a phenomenology of friction, like the Stokes drag, or there's a theory of friction that's saying that the apparent velocity-dependent drag force is coming because of...
This is the inelastic collision, remember. This is the term that dominates, controls the inelastic collision, which is not what we used to in what you're talking about. This is the term which is basically how much energy I'm losing for each collision.
I see why it's different.
If you do collisions the way you usually do it, what you say is that the relative velocity reduces by a certain percentage when the particles
collide.
Right, so the force has to reduce by that percentage times the mass of the
mass particle.
Right. It's because it's that kind of friction.
It's an inelastic, these are the inelastic contributions.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's fine. I'm sorry. I never thought about it that way, and so I never.
Yeah.
It's okay. There are two types of experiments that are done. One is to basically take a system box like this, pour particles in. In fact, what I'm showing here is just the movable region. Down here, there should be particles filling up the rest of the space, and so you just pour things in through a container. And then you things flow. They set up. You know, they'll start fill up the bottom, and then finally they'll start to get to enough angle. They'll start to flow. Okay. So these flow regimes. These are the type of experiments that are done by Doug Durian and several others. And what you end up with is a flowing region which is somewhere on the order of 10 to 15 diameters high, thick. All right. It's very hard to get any more than that because the only variable you control is the flow rate. Okay. So you set a flow rate. If you increase the flow rate, what happens is they start to flow faster, and you can't get too much of a thick pile. Okay, so this is one regime, the type of experiment. The other one is to basically, literally take a plate, glue say particles of sand on the bottom, or make it felt or something that's rough enough, and then have a big amount of a gate here with a lot of material behind it, and lift the gate. Okay. By doing that, you have a little more control, and you can actually get layers which are up to, say, 20 or 30, you know, you can get small, thin layers all the way up to thicker layers of 20 or 30 or more particles flowing. Okay, the simulations I'm going to talk about are actually close to this regime, because we're going to have a plate at the bottom where we're going to put particles down, glue them down, which are frozen in the bottom, and then flow particles. The only difference is I'm going to have period boundary conditions, so things will just keep wrapping around until they come to equilibrium. I make this distinction because here we have, in these type of experiments, as in our simulations, we have independent control. Everything flows in this type of experiment, and therefore you have a height that you can control, depending on how many particles you're letting out or flowing. Here, what you have is a flowing region, which will be, the top part will look something like this, and then in fact what they actually see is an exponential fall off of the velocity into the static region. Okay, and this we won't see. In fact, that is only get surface flow in this case, whereas here we get everything flowing. And for some reason, this has been in a confusion about sometimes people do this. And just for fun, this is.
Gary, in the gate one, if you raise the gate really high, you still get everything flowing.
Everything flows because you got a base which is at above an angle, above the angle of repose, and everything will flow. This is just a little one of our little. We haven't done much on this. It's just one of the demonstrations of the program. This is a small rotating drum. All particles are the same, except they happen to be colored differently just at the beginning, and we watch them mix. Actually, there's been work on this by the group at Northwestern. We haven't gone back and done this very systematically. In fact, this is just more for kind of show the details of what we're doing.
It takes a surprisingly long time to mix.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it does mix eventually?
As I say, that we've made the movie just to show this, because it's kind of cute. And so basically, we obviously, I don't think so. We're losing enough energy.
Yeah, I think Julio was going to be here on Thursday. I don't know if he's talking about this. I don't remember.
Yeah. Okay.
His talk has the title granular. Has the word granular in the title.
Granular.
No.
Something
when is this?
On Thursday, there's a chemical engineering seminar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, okay. All right, so we have a granular week. Okay, so the problem I'm going to talk about in detail is this flow down incline plane. We have a system which is literally, again, rough bottoms, particles at the bottom. I'm just going to tilt it up and let it see what happens. If you, of course, because it's not water, if you tilt it up a little bit, nothing happens. You get the shear stresses a little bit, but nothing yields. And you get a flow line, which is red points, which is that is it's the minimum angle you need to keep a system flowing. As you notice, it depends on the height. If it's a very thick pile, that number for our spherical case is somewhere around 19 degrees. As you make thalls thinner and thinner, you're losing energy with the bottom too fast, and in fact you have to tilt it higher to get it to stay flowing. And in fact, if you first start to tilt it, you have to go above this minimum flow angle to something called the angle maximum angle stability. That's these green points. That is, if you start from a dense state, you start tilting up. When you get to 19 degrees, nothing really happens. You got to get it above that. Okay, this is well known. There's a difference between the angle of repose and maximum angle stability in experimental systems. So we see that, and then of course once you get it flowing, you can go back down and measure the angle of repose. Okay. There's another angle, and there's two maximum angles, which is above which you tilt so much that you're adding gravity energy from gravity so rapidly that the thing continues to accelerate. Obviously, in the limit, if you tilt it like this, it's just going to fall, right? Well, that's about that depends on the material parameters. It depends on how inelastic the collisions are, but it's somewhere in the range of 28, 30 degrees or something for our spherical systems. So if you tilt it more than that, what it literally happens is they run down, and the simulation eventually actually lift off. And the entire thing goes running around, and all of a sudden the density off the bottom, you'll just see the whole thing just move up. And if you put a top somewhere way up here, it'll go crash in the top and come back down. It'll do fun things like this.
And if you don't have a top, but just have a very, very long ramp, then it'll jump?
It'll just tilt. No, if it's in a simulation, it'll just eventually lift off, and it'll go off in this direction, and it'll just move off this way.
Going on.
There's nothing to stop it. Right. Okay. So what we've done is look at this very carefully. Most of the simulations are done about this size. They're about 20 diameters this way, about 10 in the vorticity direction. We've checked that if you vary this dimension of that, you get the same result. And then we varied the height. And most of what I'm going to talk about today is this thick pile regime. And we've also worried a little bit about the crossover to the flow. And we do see at the at below 10, the things are different. Not surprising. You've got two boundaries at the bottom and the top, and they get very close together. And so, obviously, the simple theory one would be thick enough, so we can avoid that.
These boundaries are periodic boundaries, or what are they?
They're periodic in the flow direction and in the vorticity direction.
Okay.
And then in just a rough base. By dimensional analysis, there should be a gamma dot. The stress should go like the strain rate squared. And there's a simple theory due to Bagnell that dates back to the early 50s, which says basically if the density was constant, then you would expect that the average velocity to scale like the height to the 3/2. Okay, now we want to look at those. So here is just the flow. This is a much bigger system. This is 200 diameters long. And what you see is the flow. It's moving much faster at the top than at the bottom. I'll show you the velocity profiles in a minute. I'll do that again. Okay. It's a platypus. This is... there's a very nice software that if you make TIFF files to convert them to AVI files, minimal AVI files, there's a company. You can download for free the software. And if you download the free version, you get the platypus. Okay. If you pay the $25 registration fee, which I do for some of the we eventually did, then you get the version without the platypus. But it's great software. It's fine. It's really nice software because it actually makes a very very compact. This is like a 10 megabyte file instead of being 100 megabytes if you just did it yourself or something. So it's very nice software. And it was actually, they call it because it's made from pieces of everything. That's why they call it platypus. Okay. For fun, we started looking at a little bit. This is what happens if you put a little bit of a little wall in there. Of course, that's a periodic wall because there's another one down here. But of course, it goes up and over.
Yeah, it seems to never go up.
Right. So it's okay. No. Let's look at some of the results. Weird projector because those are not so light. Okay. The first thing is these are simulations that's the first time they came out so light, in two dimensions and in three, with as a function of angle. And the first thing, here's this over here because you can see these better, is notice that the densities are extremely flat. There's a little bit of structure at the base, and then they roll off. These are the velocities distributions as you go up an angle. The first thing, of course, is that everything flows, which for some people have walked up and said, you've got to be doing something stupid because everything's not supposed to flow. Okay. Well, everything flows because you've got a rough base, okay, and you're tilting. It's not like the bottom is full of sand and then, of course, the top layer is flowing. This, everything's there and you tilt it. Okay. And hopefully the next one comes out clear. Okay. If you look at the, in this limit where in your thick piles, these are piles which are roughly of order 40 to 100 high or 25 to 200 in two dimensions. And what you see is the density is independent of the height of the pile. Okay. If I went to a steeper angle, I didn't mention that before, of course it dilates more. That was happening in the previous version here. This is different angles, 20, 22, 24, and 26. Of course, not surprisingly, the more you tilt it, the more it dilates. But you get extremely flat density profiles which roll off. And here are the velocities distributions. And if you take this little red thing, heat curve here, and take this point and put it on top of that point there, or the green curve, so this point is on top of that point, they'll lie on top of each other. That is, if you're sitting on top of the pile and co-moving with the pile, you look down, you can't tell how deep you are. Okay. All right. So one of the mysteries which we don't understand is first is why is the density flat? Okay. And this turns out to I'll show you in a second the functional form for this, but it has this very nice velocity, the kinetic energy goes like the height cubed, or the velocity, average velocity goes like the height to the 3/2.
You can't tell how deep, deep it is unless you know the angle you're looking
at. No, these are all the same angle.
Oh.
Yeah, if you knew the density, you could say something about how deep you were. You wouldn't know how deep you were, you only knew what angle you were. The angle sets the density, but since the roll-offs here are identical, and this velocity here, if I was to shift it up so I was co-moving, so that point was the same there, and this blue point was matched to that point, this little section here is exactly that little section over there. Okay, so you can't actually look down and say how deep you are. You can only tell it is flowing, and you can't tell where the bottom is. Okay, now the kinetic energy, of course, is, I don't have a plot, the kinetic energy is doing the opposite. There's, again, because of Newton's law, if you look from the bottom again, as a function of, say, the average temperature, the fluctuations about that curve, they look like that. Okay. Fluctuations at the top are small, the fluctuations at the bottom are the biggest ones. The stress does exactly the same thing. That's partly because of, that's basically set by...
Fluctuations, Gary, in the velocity.
The velocity.
Fluctuations in the velocity.
So if I plotted V minus V bar squared as a function of depth, look little slices. This is at the bottom. It's at the okay. Now that's not surprising. If I'm going to keep the density constant, the particles at the bottom have to be rattling faster.
Yes. Okay.
Just to give me, you know, right.
Well,
they might be rattling faster to give me a pressure to lift all this stuff up. Otherwise, if they were rattling slower, the density would have to compact. If the temperature had been uniform, then the bottom would have to be denser. But almost from the fact that I tell you the density is flat, then you know what the fact the density is flat, you know what the temperature has to be doing. And of course, the stresses have to be doing exactly the same thing because you've got Newton's equations, which everything has to be dependent on Z.
Now, is the flat density robust to whatever
yes.
did you take?
Whatever we change, it doesn't. We've used Hertzian versus linear springs in three dimensions. We've made the collisions be 0.98 coefficient of restitution, which is about, we need some minimum inelasticity to get things to not be unstable, down to, you know, things which are more inelastic than anything you'd ever make in the world. You know, so that 80% of the energy is taken out every time, every collision. It's still exactly the same. Only thing that happens is that those parameters will change this height. Of course, the more inelastic, for a given angle, it'll go up a little bit. The more elastic it is, again, it's more dilatancy.
It's sort of remarkable that it adopts that as a solution.
Right. Right. We don't. And I know there's no argument I know of that says why the density should adapt that behavior. Okay. A couple things. The other things you get is, of course, from force balance, you have two equations. That's just from Newton's laws, but of course you have more, you know, all these off-diagonal stresses, and that's part of the problem with these things. You don't know all the consecutive equations. So these two plus this one is what you get from Newton's equations, and then there's three more missing. Okay. Now this simple argument of what you do to Bagnell, which says in the constant density regime, you can do a momentum collision analysis, and you get that gamma dot squared is proportional to the strain. And if you solve that equation, you get this simple form for the velocity.
Actually, Gary, could you take us through that simple argument? Because I don't think it's quite obvious in one line. Do you know the two-line version?
two-line version. It's basically nothing more than a dimensional analysis.
So what are the dimensional things that come in? Is it somehow some rho g stuff, or is it something else?
Right.
Dissipation. You get dissipation.
It doesn't matter the dissipation. It depends on.
It's an energy balance with the viscosity depending on the temperature of the upper.
Right. Well, another way of, you can do it two ways. You can actually write it as the viscosity times goes like gamma dot in a prefactor. Sorry, you can do the standard liquid theory, and then this eta has to go like t to the 1/2. And because t to the 1/2, basically I think it's everything's linear with T is linear in Z. And so you can do it. You can do it this way. You can do the standard analysis.
But that's because you have a constant density thing. I mean, that profile.
Yes.
You can't do it without that.
I agree. Right.
Is that right?
Right. You have to.
I predicted this in certain transitional regimes about many years ago.
Right. What's that?
Density would be a constant.
I see.
In certain transitional regimes.
If the density is constant, then you can make
it. If it's near. The condition where the shear stress and normal stress are proportional, then you can get the density being constant as a result of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure okay, that argument I haven't seen.
Well, it never got published. But
okay, well, that's why I never saw it then. Okay, because I've never seen any argument that.
Say it again. I didn't. What's this transitional regime you're talking about?
Essentially, if you're near slip, so that the shear and normal stress are proportional to each other.
Okay.
Shear.
You get the density as a constant as a result of that.
I'm not sure. Okay, I have to.
What's the connection between?
That's a slip condition, right? Because on the Mohr circle, the shear and normal stress are probably proportional for the pile to slip. So when that happens, the density will be nearly a constant, provided everywhere in the pile that condition is satisfied.
So analytically, if everywhere in the condition you're just at criticality, then the density is a constant.
Part of the confusion is that comes into play is you can either do, because everything is linear. Because everything is linear. All these stresses are all linear with Z because of the Newton's equations. You can either do a theory which says this sigma goes like gamma dot squared, or you can go sigma goes like eta gamma dot, where this eta goes like T to the 1/2, which also goes like Z to the 1/2. Okay, both of which will give you the same answer. Okay, so it's a question of whether you want to base it on a liquid-like theory or
an energy balance condition in addition to that.
What's that?
You need an energy balance condition in addition to that.
Right, to get this to get this one, yeah. Right. Okay.
Why is eta goes to T in
the half? That's what you get from the energy when you
from kinetic theory you get that.
That's a little more subtle. There's a long paper by Tom Lubensky and several others that basically start from this assumption and work through the details. At the end, you end up with a.
Eta going is T to the 1/2. If you just did kinetic theory, even for gases, you get T to the 1/2.
Right.
The granular bit is because T is going in Z. I mean, none of the rest.
Right. So this part, is just kinetic theory.
Anyway.
And they assume that, and for reasons that are unknown, why would that work? Is not clear.
Right. I mean, that's something.
Another way of saying the question is why would the simple kinetic theory prediction of eta going like 2 to the 1/2 work? Okay, and then these two are equivalent because of the fact that the linear, because the temperature is linear in Z, everything has a Z or Z to the 1/2 power. So these are all equivalent. So if I take this equation with this up here, I can just integrate it. It's a trivial equation. So you end up with a velocity which has this form, and those fit the data excellently. Okay, this x to the 3/2, and of course gives the average velocity goes like h to the 3/2. Okay, you can extract from the simulations. In fact, the way the simulations, of course, give you the entire depth profile of velocity, which we can fit to this form. In the experiments, when you do those experiments where you lift the trough up, all you do is you measure the velocity at the top. Okay, so we went back and measured the velocity at the top. And if you scale it, it's something called a Froude number, which is V times GH, that's actually a 1/2 up here. You get a straight line, for this is the simulation data, and the experimental data is also a straight line with a slightly different slope, which probably comes from the fact that there are material property differences. Okay. And in fact, this straight line actually extends down to a very few number of layers. Okay. And it's straight only if you normalize the H by the distance from the flow line.
Distance from the flow line mean, I'm sorry.
Remember, this is that was that curve that
obviously missed something. Oh, I see.
That was that curve that went like h theta had a line that looked like that. So it's the distance from that line, if you measure the velocity at the top. Poliquin has done a lot of experiments and shown that's his observation. He was actually the first one to see experimentally this flow line, that is the amount that was first observed experimentally, that the amount of the pile thickness depends on the angle to get it flowing, keep it flowing. And the shape of our curve is very nearly the same as the experimental one. Of course, these are done with glass beads or sand, you know, quasi-spherical particles.
So each step is okay. So that's the.
That's the curve. That's this curve here.
Oh, okay. So for each angle, there's a
slightly different. As you get the low piles, you've got to normalize by a slightly different number.
So lots of things I'm still confused about. This sigma going as gamma dot squared.
Right.
Is it important that there's gravity there, or if I just had this thing in the space shuttle and I did the same experiment that made it go?
You need gravity.
I see. So then in that case, it's not a constitutive equation of the fluid.
Flow will be the same regardless of what is causing the shape.
I mean, it's important to make the distinction, because in the one case you're talking about equations of motion for a granular fluid in which gravity is put in as an external force. In the other case you're saying that the
I think you need gravity, because you don't get this linear dependence on z for the temperature, etc., is the fact that there's gravity around. I've got a direction. If I've got two plates that do the exact same thing between two plates, and I shear the plates, then I've got I haven't broken the symmetry. Okay, so we haven't done that simulation yet, but
the experiment is done with inert element, right?
With gravity. No, these are done with by Poliquin, etc., and they're done with gravity.
The one where you have no gravity, and he has the Coetzel.
But he hasn't done this. No, yeah. We haven't done Coetzel.
No, yeah, but he only looks at the velocity gradient that way. It's not good enough.
That's different.
The way it's sitting, the way it's back, everything's done.
Everything's similar to gravity. We haven't done it in a zero gravity between plates case, which this can't be true. I mean, it has to be the shear stress will presumably be, uniform across.
Just make the argument, it can be proportional to the strain, because it's not temperature,
isn't it?
It has to be proportional to the square of the strain.
Right. Okay. Couple of things you can look at is, one, you can ask a little more detailed questions. That's the steady state problem, regime. Basically, everything's very robust. It doesn't depend on the parameters. You get these uniform densities, which I think is not, except we unpublished thing claims that it actually has an explanation, which would be nice to see, as well as a prediction for the amount of dilatancy, etc. And so there's the only one theory paper I know about on this is a recent one by Lubensky, and again on this case. And he mostly gets things which are much more dilatant than here. The other thing, a couple other things you can look at. One is you can ask, well, how does the flow begin? So let's take a state where I'm not flowing, and zero at angle. Now I tilt it up, and what would you expect to happen? Well, you can ask basically the first question is, well, you got to tilt it up to an angle where there's some shear plane that's gonna give. All right. If you do this in two dimensions, where this packing is a triangular lattice, because you got to tilt to 30 degrees before there's a slip plane in the triangular lattice. Well, because what we do is we put, then what happens is, depends on if you make the base rough, that actually is where the slip plane starts. So what happens is it starts to flow as a plug from the bottom, and this thing just eats up the sample and goes, this order region goes up. Similar thing happens in three dimensions. These are from these very long trough experiments of 200 long. We stop the flow, and then we tilt it up to from say 0 up to say 23, 24 degrees. And again, the same thing happens. It disorders at the base. The first shear plane is at the rough base, and that starts to be disordered. And the fluctuations start moving there, and they simply eat up the sample as you go straight up. So you get these plug regions. These are different times for short times, and these are for longer times. And finally, you get to the long time regime, where everything is flowing. Okay.
How does the density of the moving area compare with the final density?
It gets 90, very close to the final one very quickly. We haven't. I looked more carefully in two-dimensional simulations, but it would not tell a very different, within a few percent of what the final density is going to be before it, when it starts to move. You can do the same thing in reverse. You can take a tilting system and lower it below the angle of repose, and these are the initial state going down in time. And in fact, the cessation of flow doesn't start from the top, but again, it begins from the bottom. Okay, and I think it's because, remember, the temperature is the hottest down here, and so that starts to damp out, the energy starts getting damped out faster there. So you actually get things start collapsing from the bottom down. And if you look at the thermal fluctuations, you get the same picture. Okay. Now, what we noticed recently was kind of, because it was a little bit of faddish and I couldn't keep Leo off to doing the fads things a little bit. He wanted to make an analogy between, and I think it is a reasonable analogy, between these flowing states and the glass transition. Again, basically we have is hard spheres type systems. So if you looked at the kinetic energy or the density as a function of the angle, this is just a collapse of the data we had before, you see the kinetic energy come down, and of course it stopped at some point. And if you looked at the pair correlation functions in the flowing state, again, the red one is at 26 degrees down toward just when it's just barely moving at 19 degrees, you get this characteristic split-second peak, etc., of a glass transition of hard spheres. Not surprising. I mean, you're just making another way of making a hard sphere-type system. Okay.
The system's anisotropic, though.
There's a weak anisotropy in G of R. This is kind of averaging over that weak anisotropy, but it's relatively weak.
Okay.
But yes, strictly speaking, at 26, there's a small anisotropy in the different directions.
But in the state you get stuck in, finally, you can't detect the fact that it's moving in a particular direction, or you can.
You'd have to look very, very difficult, very, very, very good. It turns out you're probably a little bit lower density than dense random packing, because you kind of dropped down and you haven't really settled. So your density is more like 6.2 or something. Well, of course it's friction, so let's get back to that, because you're not going to get dense random packing because it's friction.
Gary, a related question about the kinetic theory arguments. Everything you wrote down was a scalar argument.
Yes.
Are the arguments scalar throughout the basin? There's a scalar viscosity.
Yes. It's not clear it's right, but that's what's assumed. Okay. Thomas and Denise tried very hard to do a tensor theory, and just were unable to closure, basically. There's a couple things you can look at. If you're in the flowing state, this is basically the fraction of those. It's the shear force divided by the maximum shear force, which remember was cut off by the Coulomb criteria. So if I take a reasonable value of mu of about a half, in the flowing state, of course, not surprising, everything's moving. They're rotating a lot. So when things come in contact, they quickly rotate against each other so much that the shear force would grow indefinitely, but it has to get truncated by the Coulomb criteria. Okay, so what happens here, this is a distribution of those of that ratio in the flowing state at high angles. In fact, there's something like 25% or something. There's a big delta function up here, which are things are stuck. And they're moving, they kind of rotate against each other so much, now they're sliding as pairwise. Okay, also at 26 degrees or so, you only have about one contact on average. Okay, it's again, you dilate in Z down about 50%, and so you've got things are really kicking around fast and they're kind of rotating. As soon as when you stop the system, get below the angle of repose, all these forces kind of course they're sitting here, they're kind of rotating this way, of course they want to slow up, so they kind of, they go back. Okay, so everything backs off the Coulomb criteria in the stop state. Okay, so you have this plastic to elastic transition. So the flowing contacts are basically plastic, that is, they're stuck together, sliding against each other. In the stop state, they're almost all elastic, they're below the Coulomb criteria.
Yeah, any comments about, even though the contacts are plastic, is there a percolation of plastic contacts through the system?
No. In the flowing state, it
doesn't percolate right through it.
So. No, because in the flowing state, you only have like, even at these angles above 22, you only have, I have the plot somewhere, you have like, around here, you have like, in three dimensions, you have like one contact on average. So even all the contacts won't even if they're not, total contacts won't even percolate.
The percolation has to occur due to collisions, right?
Everything's collision dominated.
Okay. Even where, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Now, let me spend a few minutes talking about packing. These are different systems. I want to show the effect of friction compared to non-friction. These are, one of our colleagues was fond of doing these loose random packing models where you pour particles down one at a time, you let one settle, and you do the next one and let it settle. Okay, and they were doing these for packing ceramic particles into molds and trying to understand what happens with polydispersity, et cetera. So here's a loose random packing state, about 57%. Took our simulation, put a top on it here. This is with the sidewall, flat sidewalls, and shook it a few times, up and down just a few times. And this is with friction, and this is without friction. Okay. So without, you know, remember the dense random packing is somewhere around 64%, et cetera. So you get close to that with no friction, but you get pretty far from that with friction. And of course, obviously the sidewalls are very...
Well, the walls.
They're walls. This particular case is the walls. Okay. So this is just a little slight demonstration that our first indication that, in fact, friction was playing a dominant role in how you pack. Okay. So we wanted to look at that in more detail. And the reason for that is this simple argument that says if you have frictionless spheres, of course you need six contacts to be stable. That's the old argument. And in fact, at dense random packing of hard spheres, you have six. You can't get more than six because then that's basically dense random packing and six neighbors are equivalent, turns out. Okay. With friction, because you have these tangential shear forces, you only need four contacts in three dimensions. And okay, so we're going to call packings which are at their limits respectively isostatic. So the question was, what happens if I put a little bit of friction on? You know, I use this coefficient of friction mu to go from zero to a finite number, non-zero number, to control how much friction I'm putting on. Do I expect to jump from a packing from six and suddenly I put a little bit of friction on and I jump to four, or do I get anywhere near four? The second thing is that these kind of pictures of force chains, fragility, etc., in packings are true presumably only if you're very near isostatic, if you're very near four contacts. If you have more than four contacts, you're going to get chain splitting, and you can well imagine that these kind of granularity pictures are probably not going to hold. So it's important to decide whether, in fact, you want to think of these things as near the isostatic limit for frictional cases or not. So what we did is we looked at this, and we looked at this in the following way. We took a very tall column, which is way above the roof here, very dilute, and turned on gravity. And here is the case with, there's no walls here. The little boundaries are just the guide to the eye. And so we're just going to take this tall column, and sorry, it wasn't tall, that was, and it was later in the simulation. Uh-huh. And they bounce a bit. So this is frictionless particles.
Is it a constant pressure simulation?
No. There's no pressure. I just have a tall column at about 6%, 12% dilution, and I just make a tall column and turn everything on and let them drop, with turn gravity on.
Just tracks the highest particle.
The top is just tracking the highest particle.
Where does the energy go if they're frictionless?
It's still the normal. There's still the normal coefficient of friction. Restitution. And here's the same thing with friction. Friction coefficient about a half. Actually, two things. One is the height is lower. It's higher here, which means the density is down by a bit. Okay, and so now what we do is that's the quick part of the simulation. We then run it, and we wait and wait and wait and wait, because what we want to do is get all the kinetic energy out. And in fact, literally, this happens in about 5% of the simulation time, and then we wait another few million steps, sometimes multiple hours, days on a computer to get the last bit of kinetic energy out. And what happens is, there's these long wavelength modes, right? This thing kind of pushes down and then pushes back up. So the kinetic energy oscillates about some value. And finally, the lowest wavelength mode gets its energy sucked out and the kinetic energy drops off the table. And it's after it drops, we want to go in there and count the neighbor distribution. Okay, because I want to be able to say how many contacts are there. Okay. And of course, when it's still got some finite kinetic energy, they're bouncing next to each other, and that's not a well-defined quantity. Okay, so these, in fact, these simulations, unlike dense random packing of hard spheres, frictionless spheres, where you can just throw particles in a box, do a conjugate gradient method, and just compress the thing very quickly, dense random packings. Here you actually have to follow, again, because they're history dependent. It depends on how you made them, how much they were rotating, how they got the kinetic energy out. So you have no choice but to have some patience and run them. So typically these were run, even at this system size, some of the parameters would take more than a week or two on 24 processors. Next one. This is the same thing with walls. They're actually flat walls here. This is the frictional case. They're actually bouncing off the wall a bit. The last guys.
You see the energies. Yeah, there must be some internal modes.
Okay. So then you wait for a while. Then there's a frictional case. This is no friction case. This is very near the end simulation, where you see also the effect of the wall. Much more order and effect in the frictionless case than in the frictional case. Here, basically, the wall does very little compared to here. Okay. And we'll just do one more. Or this is a cylindrical wall with friction. That one does have more damping. And this one is poured into a container, which is, come on, go. The container is wider than the spout. Now let's look at the details. This is the effect of the friction on the number of neighbors. So this is Z is the number of contacts. These were made in the case with the periodic boundary conditions, so I don't have to worry about the boundary. But we've also done the periodic case. We also done with walls and just state looked at the middle. And what happens is this is a finite spring constant. It's not infinite. So in the frictionless case, you get something above 6. And I'll show you in the middle as you turn on this spring constant larger and larger, this number will drop to 6 as you expect. And a little bit of friction doesn't do much. Okay. And eventually, they come down and flatten off. And of course, not surprisingly, once you get above a coefficient of friction of order 1, 1 and 100 is the same, because the tangential forces never really get much bigger than the normal forces, because my tangential spring constant was very comparable with order 1 times the normal one. Okay, so mu of 1 and mu of 100 or infinity are the same. Okay, but you never get anywhere near this value 4. These are for pretty elastic, and this is extremely inelastic. It means you're losing 75% of the kinetic energy on a collision. Okay, and you need very, very inelastic collisions to get anywhere near this denser packing. And here's the density. Again, you're getting near the 64% for the frictionless case, and you're getting much lower values, 60 or below, with friction. Of course, the number of neighbors are down. Okay. These are done with the packing. We've done the same. We stop the flow on the inclined plane, and we get very comparable numbers. What you're really doing is not really changing the shape of the distribution of neighbors. You're just shifting the mean. So here's the distribution P of Z for different coefficients of friction, and all you do is kind of march it down to the left. In the frictionless case, we vary the spring constant by several orders, about 4 or 6 orders of magnitude. And we see that as we go to the hard sphere limit, we get near 6, which is what one would like to see, which we're used to for the hard, dense random packing of hard spheres. Not surprising.
I'm sort of puzzled by the precision of that result. You have a distribution of values for Z.
Yes.
And you say that the average is exactly 6 in the hard sphere limit.
The average is 6.
And is that mathematically rigorous? Or?
It's not mathematically rigorous. There have been lots of simulations by a number of groups, including we did some 4 or 5 years ago. A number of groups have measured the number of neighbors at dense random packing, and it's very near 6. It's, you know, between 5.99 and 6.01 or something.
Stability required to be 6.
Yeah, it also requires to be stability.
Requires the average to be 6?
The average. Doesn't tell you
if you have a sphere with less than 6.
You can still be, if you're surrounded in a dense packing, you don't have to have 6. You need about 4 not to rattle. But you can.
Stability argument. I was assuming that your stability argument was an argument about how many points you require to stabilize a single particle.
No. Well, it is, but it's in a bulk. You can account. You can have a finite number of. You can have the distribution. That distribution is pretty close to this distribution here for the mu equals zero is pretty close to the ones that people measured, including myself, for conjugate gradient. Very large simulations of dense random packing of hard spheres just by compressing them using conjugate gradient techniques.
Well, I guess I suppose you chopped off all the ones greater than 6 and imagine the distribution just goes up to 6 and then falls off. They happen to be less than 6. Why would that be not stable? So I don't quite understand the stability argument.
The stability argument, remember, is the way I think about it is you have a big, huge dynamic matrix. And you have all these non-zero matrix elements. You have to invert the dynamic matrix and make sure there are no negative eigenvalues. It's a many-body stability criteria. Okay. Now the simple argument is the simple counting argument, which we do, is on a single sphere. But in fact, that's not the way you actually have to do the calculation, right? You have to actually if you ask whether it's a unstable mode. Take a square lattice. Okay. A square lattice is stable. If I put a finite fraction of holes in there, it's unstable because there's some shear mode in there. Okay, but I don't know exactly which one until I invert the whole entire dynamical matrix and I know which way to shear it for that unstable mode.
Then doesn't that depend on the details of the packing, exactly where all the spheres are?
It's not. Nobody. You don't have to have 6. It's not like you have to have a lot. I mean, otherwise, if you take a dense random packing, you can well imagine that not everybody has exactly the same number of contacts, neighbors.
Sure.
Okay, the number 6 is it's a little more subtle. The simple hand-waving argument is it's 6 because that's what each one has to have. But in fact, that actually works on average. Mm-hmm. It's the stability. It's actually the right way I think about it is that I need, as I have 3 n equations of motion, and I need an equal number
constraints,
and the number of constraints in an n-body system should be equal to the number of 3 n.
That
would
work for
a particle. Right. I can make the argument for an ensemble. And it's the total number of constraints equals the number of forces. And so this is well known in that problem. So, we don't look at the wage distribution. We've done our best to take our data for this frictional case and again go over as many orders of magnitude of the spring constant as we can. The problem with this is, in the simulation-wise, is that the as you increase the spring constant by a factor of 10, the time step goes down by the square root of 10. Okay, because that's the high-frequency mode goes like the square root of the spring constant. So we can vary the spring constant only up to a 4 or 5 orders of magnitude, and then I tried a longer one and I gave up after running for 300 million time steps for about a half a year. On 24 processors or something, I literally could not get the lowest frequency mode out, and I gave up. But it doesn't matter because another factor of 10 wouldn't help much. In all these cases, you see that we extrapolate back to a finite number of contacts in the hard sphere limit. Even in the lowest we get is 4.3, and that's a case which is very large friction and extremely inelastic collisions. Okay. These numbers depend a little bit on the initial starting density and several other things. But in fact, my claim is that you never get near the isostatic case of 4. You're always overdetermined by at least 10%, which means is, in my mind, these pictures of, fragility, pictures of force chains and packings are probably totally irrelevant in the sense that they're screened in some very short length, kind of along the lines of Levine and Bouchard's more recent theory of a year or so ago, okay, where you get kind of, you can think of this as force chains, but they very quickly decay with some correlation length, which maybe is 5 to 10 lattice diameters, and then you get back to a continuum elastic type theory.
Sorry, could you explain the connection between those two? You mentioned two things, which is this 10% overdetermination and screening force chains, and I'm just not...
Well, I think it's basically is, when you try to draw the force chains, the picture is that if you push here, the force change will keep going this way, and it'll go this way. Right, but when you're overdetermined with the constraints, what happens is every one of these things starts getting some splitting.
Oh, yes, okay.
Okay, and it's you have to be, if you were right at 4, you can imagine this picture would work. But when you start getting more constraints, then you more equations of more of these forces you have to deal with, then there's no way that these things are going to be so well defined. There, and I can't tell you, because I haven't done it, for each of these different systems, what is the correlation length and how that relates to this packing length.
Okay. Is there a prediction for that?
Or what's that?
Is there a prediction for how long the correlation length is depending upon the distance from
no.
number 4?
There's none that I know of. That would be a nice thing to do.
So you're relying on a property of propagator for forces in one of these packings, and without, what's the property that you get without the?
This is my speculation. I don't have a proof of this. My speculation is that, and it's consistent with the way that Bouchard and Levine and now think about the other Levine think about this, is that that you're overdetermined. And in these packings, and therefore you get these splittings of force chains over some correlation length, which presumably is somehow related to how nigh isostatic you are, how hypostatic you are.
But the original theory assumed that the force length chain never split. That was about point. If I push on a particular bead, it goes down a single force chain.
Right. Right.
How well established was that idea that you?
It's not established because if you look at the the few people who have published force chain distributions, or even the experiments on disks, which are when you push on them, they're stress sensitive, and you see them polarizes. They're splitting all over the place. Okay, I've seen. There's no evidence that this works in any system. Okay, and in fact, it's clear that if you look at the pictures of Rajai and others of force chains, there's no way you can go in there and define. I mean. Let me get back. That another here. Here is in that same light. Here's the distribution of forces that we find in our simulations, with no friction through friction. So there's not much difference with friction and no friction. The only difference is that there's a little turn up, which we think is real, at low forces, with friction. Okay. And it turns out we now realize that in fact these are down in the case where you couldn't resolve these experimentally. So in fact, if you replot this data, where you throw away the very low forces, it's going to be put a threshold on it, and of course you actually change the shape out here because you've changed the normalization a little bit. Okay, but in the force chain picture, you say, okay, well, where? Okay, I'll pick a number. I'll plot all force chains above a certain force. Okay, well, I can make them percolate or not percolate depending on where I make my cutoff. Okay, and this distribution is so wide, there's no sense of large forces and small forces. Okay, and therefore it's very hard to, and several of us have tried, Nagel and Andrea have tried, and we've tried to look at the force chains and try to come up with some measure that you can actually more than just show a picture and wave your hands. And nobody's really come up with any kind of a simple correlation function, because they literally look like they split like crazy, and there's no way, you know, from any of the things you've seen, you know, they look like dielectric patterns of pushing on some, you know, hitting them on place.
Is the simple consequence of this get the experiments, the force distribution under a conical sample? And I seem to remember Whitmer and Cates saying something about this. They have two versions of that, which is also...
So
if you have single chains and no splitting, then you get actually zero.
This whole thing was started by a notion that if you take a conical pile and you look at the distribution of forces on the base, the naive picture is the pressure is highest in the center and it falls off on the sides, and it's not true. There's a hole in the middle. Okay. It also turns out that it's very dependent on how you make the packings. Berenger has made packings where you literally, you know, take these mounds and you pour sand from a point and you get one answer, or you pour it from a whole area and you get a completely different answer. Okay, and so one of the things we think we might be able to do is to play with that a bit, but I don't think to explain that one can do that in continuum theory, and it's very so dependent on the history that yes, whether there's a minimum or not.
You can, but you certainly need some notion of principal and secondary stress counts.
That's what we mean on this force chain, that it has to be some sort of force clustering or force concentrations.
Yes.
You wouldn't get any strain distribution like that.
Yes, you need, the granularity comes into play. I think on a large length scale, I guess it's back to a continuum equation. On some intermediate length scale, there's some remnants of granularity depending on this correlation length. But it also depends on the history.
Back to continuum, I mean, that's many, many parts. I mean, this odd result about the force across the bottom
my guess is if we had a better model of the consecutive equations, it would probably fall out of. I mean, again,
naively, these pile results are not consistent with continuum elasticity. So it isn't just a rapid crossover after a few diameters in continuum elasticity.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure of that.
So whether it's high effective. No, what you mean by elasticity? Yeah.
Right.
You can get them from continuum, but have a model.
At this stage, I don't have a lot to say about that. Only the fact that it's clear to me that it's very hard. It's very hard to make packings which are isostatic, where one would expect these correlation lines to be long. Okay.
For sure, don't get continuum elasticity in the traditional sense in the far field either. They get like a Poisson ratio that's not level legal.
But they have these funny artifacts and everything about forces.
They have problems with forces coming back and hitting the surface, and they claim, well, then somebody moves epsilon and those disappear. So you only look at the force chains that are legal in the end to make their model work. So there's some extra rules that are essentially non-analytic fixes.
Yeah. And that's a game that I'm not sure yet where the simulations can play a role. I mean, if we really worked hard, we could pour a million particles from a single point and make a conical pile. But I'm not sure we're going to learn much more than. I mean, we get the whole force distribution throughout the system as opposed to just the bottom. And so ultimately, I think that's going to have to be done. But that's a. That may clear up some of the discussions. Anyway, so let me just summarize. We have a nice effective code. The gravity of a given flow, the density is, which you remember, the density is uniform. The stress satisfies simple scaling relationships, neither of which we really understand in great detail. There's some similarities between the jamming transition and at the angle of repose and the regular glass transition. The frictional spheres are isostatic. You have pretty distant 66 neighbors. The frictional ones are strongly dependent on the history. The material parameters are indefinitely hyperstatic. They're definitely not isostatic. And what we're doing in the middle now is we're looking at effects of sidewalls. It turns out it's an interesting problem of silos. You know, if you pour stuff into a container with walls, it very depends. You know, you get all these great pictures of the old pictures of silos falling over. Okay. Well, what happens is if we pour the particles in very gently, then you get a stress that saturates with height, of course, because you get bridging across the sidewall, so the pressure doesn't keep increasing with depth, and you get normal stresses on the side. Okay, when we pour them in violently, as we pour them in real fast, again, we take one of these very tall columns, so the top particles are coming in, are accelerating like crazy. They come in, and they bounce, and they push back up, and they push against the sidewalls. Okay, so you get overstressed on the sidewalls. You get these huge forces built up on the side from the way you poured the stuff in. So the ones that come in real quick, they bounce back, and then they kick up. So you get these forces that are back upwards against the sidewalls. And you can imagine that's one of the reasons why these silos would fail. Okay, so we're kind of looking at that. And then we're looking at flow. And ultimately, you want to look at slurries, which basically to put an environment around them which is fluid-like, which is the actual motivation of the Exxon people. Originally, because they sold this as the first step in understanding mudslides. Got to have some hook to tell the people around why you're going to pay for this.
There's been a lot of work on slurry reports by various people doing various techniques.
Well, there's no atomistic particulate modeling that I know of on this scale. There's lots of continuum slurries. There's lots of experiments by Minnesota and lots of other people. I don't know the literature very well. I only know this kind of peripherally.
The problem they have is creating huge ensembles of particles is that you can't get the local fluid mechanics right for lots of particles and then still have a, you know, have an acceptable size.
Well, in principle, we know how to do this because there's been work by John Brady at Caltech, I think it's Caltech, and then Melrose and Ball, and actually it was Leo, part of Leo Silbert's thesis, was colloids, dense colloids, where you have a, you kind of treat the hydrodynamics, and because it's a dense system, you can get the, you don't have to do the whole big inversion of an Imenberg matrix. So you can do that type of thing. All you're doing here is actually adding to that problem the rotation and the friction, which we know how to do. And so we can actually combine the two and do slurries, we think, without without.
You would be doing deterministic hydrodynamics, no actual noise.
There's no noise here.
Right.
Okay. No, there's no.
I have no noise term in my
there's
simulation
now. There's no deterministic hydrodynamics there either, unless you look at short time scales.
No, he means you would explicitly add in the noise.
Yeah, you're not adding Brownian.
There's no Brownian motion. There's no Brownian motion in these.
Right. I was just saying, Brady actually does colloidal systems with Brownian motion.
Both.
He does both, but he does them in the but for the hydrodynamic case, you're telling me that you're supposedly getting true hydrodynamics forces in the density, and you've got to be above dense slurries, which is above 50%. But that's fine. That's where we want to be. We can. That's where mudslides are, etc.
In slurries and things, is it? Is the effect of inelasticity somehow reduced because lubrication forces mean that particles never actually whack into each other?
That's probably...
A little bit of water you would think that would make a big difference. Is that correct? Or what's
that may be true. Yeah, I mean, the question is, how are you going to handle the lubrication force?
It's totally changed.
Radically different. Right. Therefore...
Well, it may well be that only the rotational degrees of freedom are important and not the fact that the friction lever comes in play because they never actually come in contact. But what's important is the fact that they can actually rotate, which is the only other physics, the only other new physics, because in fact, yeah, the lubrication forces are going to push them away. I mean, Alex has been playing a little bit with another problem, which is to put small attractive interactions on to mount for the fact that if you had moisture, what's going to happen is you get, if they've been together long enough, there'll be a meniscus forming, and then you'll get a weak attractive force. So if you add to this model a weak attractive very short range force, and then what happens is it shifts the whole phase diagram of that flow regime. You have to go to a steeper angle to get it flowing, and we think that happens is that you might get action like an avalanche where the top will be a plug and the bottom will be flowing, because again this kinetic energy here won't be enough to disturb the system, and so this part will move like a plug. And the bottom part will be where the fluctuations are. So you get like a disordered region on the bottom and a plug flow on the top. Okay. So, which we make an analogy to what's basically what you think about what happens in snow avalanches, right? Something comes down, it slides as a big sheet until it starts hits something downhill.
If you make the smallest deviation from the sphericity, is it singular? Is this problem singular?
No.
Is the spherical limit slightly not spherical, it'll still be the same?
You get the same answer. We've done some things on polydispersed on the flow. Weak polydispersity, everything's the same. If you get strong polydispersity, then you get phase separation. So if you mix discs of spheres of diameter 1 and 2, what you get is the bigger ones have a propensity to go to the top, and the smaller ones at the bottom. Okay, but in fact the flow is almost the same, but the physically you see is that you see a segregation. So the thing about the granular particles is, and we know this from experiments, is that they segregate like crazy. I mean, it's almost impossible if the things aren't identical to get them to mix. So small differences in the coefficient of restitution, small differences in the damping, small differences in the particle parameters of any type will get phase separation. I mean, these experiments by lots of people where you put two types of particles in a long glass tube and just rotate along long axis, they'll make bands pretty quickly. And you don't need a lot of, small differences, can explain that. So these things have to be a little careful, they have a tendency to phase separate. So that's actually an interesting problem. I mean, people have done, if you put a big particle at the bottom and start to flow, it'll go to the top, just the same as the Brazil nut problem. And if you have a whole bunch of particles of the same density, the bigger ones will go to the top in the chute flow. We've seen that. But small amounts of polydispersity nothing singular. It's.
I thought you were asking about non-spherical.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. That was probably similar though. If you particles aren't identical in size, I was thinking maybe even slightly elliptical.
I don't think anything would be different. We actually may be able to do it in a soft potential. And of course, the experiments were done on sand, on sifted sand, and the phase diagram that Poliquin found for this H stop and the maximum stability are nearly identical. Okay, so we don't believe that small aspherides or something like real sand or sugar or something would make any difference from what we've seen by comparing the experiments to our results. And of course, you still could get differences when things are, dumbbells or something, But basically, I think are rice grains or something. But I think the only real difference is going to be is that you're going to shift everything up. You're going to have to go to a much deeper angle to get it flowing. But once it's flowing, my guess is it's the characteristic physics is the same. As I say, we know that by comparing to various experimental results, which are not spherical.
I think from a fundamental perspective, the last topic is also particularly interesting because people have tried to develop theories of flowing suspensions, mm-hmm. which are almost identical to the kinetic theory type theories that people have developed for granular flows. And yet, the physics of what you get is often can be radically different, I think. In other words, for example, I think that in slurries, there's a strong tendency to produce non-uniform densities, for example, as a consequence of particle interactions and this so-called hydrodynamic diffusion phenomena that people have observed.
Yeah.
Lots of different, lots of things that are sort of diametrically, seem almost opposite of what you find, and yet somehow the models at the starting point, some of the models at least, one were derived one from the other. You tend to think that they would have the same.
Yeah, no, I think I don't know a lot about the literature in that area, but it seems to be one I think that could be very interesting. I mean, we've been kind of putting that on the out years for our DOE perspective, and they so either one day we'll have to put up a shut up or something, or do something else, one or the other. But I think it's a natural way to go from the kind of do these things with the dry grains, and then you can either put the moisture effect in, like Alex is doing, or you can. With small attractive interactions, or you can go to the fact that they're real slurries. And I think that, I agree. I don't think there's anything of this level in that literature of this comparable size and scale and things. Not that the system sizes and time scales and such that we were assessing here. I think it may slow things down by a factor of two or three, but they're not introducing those hydrodynamic effects in the dense slurries. It's not something that's going to kill you by a factor of 10 or something. And even a factor of 10, we could handle. As the number of processors go up.
Thanks, Gary.